floor is open.
Can I ask a sort of question? But it comes up a little bit sort of implied in the way you respond by saying that these indirect forms of ownership for people in the sort of the quote-unquote working class, I think your example is it only is about 10% of their income as opposed to about 15% of the higher income brackets. How those indirect forms of ownership have little effect on the class structure. That sort of brings in the question of finance capital and whether that can be explained as productive capital or means of production.
When I said that having a small pension on the side from a 401k doesn't fundamentally change the class structure, I was referring to the issue of how much do the interests of people become shaped by the fact that they are indeed owners of means of production in a limited way. I guess I would want to clarify that by the following. I do think a capitalism in which all workers have 10% of their pensions bound up in investments which they make is different in its class character. That's a change in its class relations from a capitalism in which no workers do. And if it is 25%, it's even more different. So that I would argue that it introduces another kind of complexity, which I refer to as contribution class locations. But I would, in the context of the discussion with Pakulski, I would argue it's not classless complexity. It's precisely complexity in the way in which people are located with respect to class mechanisms. And that's how to interpret the complexity, that it means that in deciding on strategies about their future, workers who have significant investments in the stock market on the side face a different strategic environment where they will be weighing the pros and cons, the trade-offs between increased militancy, let's say, as one possible course of action versus increased regulation of the stock market to protect their investments or something like that. You know, their calculations will be different. So that's in response to my specific concerns. Now, whether the other question about whether finance capital is productive or not, that's actually a pretty complicated issue. It might seem like it's not. And that's because the activities that get taken by finance capital involve two kinds of activities. One of which is, in effect, a coordinative activity in a complex economic world. Partially what finance does is gather information and decide where there are gaps in various kinds of markets, where people are demanding certain things, where there are certain kinds of investment possibilities that reallocate investments from one thing to another. And part of what that involves is lots of technical discussions and coordinations around real economic planning, but done in a private way that's subordinated to profit maximizing, but nevertheless still coordinating activities in a complex economic space. And part of what they're doing is going to a casino. You know, part of what finance capital does is play a game, like in Las Vegas, where you're making bets on future and speculating on returns and making fast trades with supercomputers that give you a quarter of a second advantage. I mean, a pure example, I think, of the completely non-productive aspect of finance capital is this controversy over this apparently strategic advantage that some finance managers have because they can make a bid a quarter of a second faster than others because of the speed of their computers, which gives them an ability to buy stocks which they know are going to rise in value a second later. And that they can buy them at the lower fare before the the lower price before the new price gets actually registered in the main computer. Well, that's a completely non-productive function. But there is a productive function that takes place that has to get done in any economy. Some complicated coordination and gathering of information to allocate resources. In capitalism, it gets subordinated to speculation and profit maximizing. But that the fact that it gets subordinated to that doesn't imply that all of the activities that take place are unproductive. But that's separate from, I think, the first question. Okay, now everybody's here. Something interesting that was discussed in a group that they want to bring to the floor. Okay, Daniel.
We were talking a little bit about Pakulski's idea of the increasing complexity of class, or the relevance of class, depending on how you look at it. And we decided that whether or not you feel it's relevant anymore, as you said, it's just different. Things are more like differentiation, occupational differentiation has led to an increasingly complex form of a class society in which it's not, if it ever was, polarized on a simple, worker, bourgeois model. It's not anymore. And we were trying to figure out when this happened. When did this change start taking place? And one of the major events that we pointed at, or major phenomenon that we pointed at in our culture, in our society, was just the industrialization and the idea that we don't have, most people aren't working in factories anymore, things like that. At which point, Adam pointed out that it's not that we don't have people working in factories anymore, it's that we still have industrial production, but we're outsourcing our industrial production for the most part now. And could you speak a little bit to the idea of on a global scale,
sure,
like how that fits into this picture?
So, one interesting exercise that one might do, which as far as I know has not been successfully done, is to say, to answer the question, what is the American class structure? Have that question be answered by finding the total labor force that's employed by American capital, wherever it might be located. And not define the American class structure as the American citizen class structure. So if you took the American class structure to be all the people who participate in the extraction of the surplus, who get the surplus, and who are employed in producing that surplus, you have a very different picture of what the American class structure looked like. Now, it would be an immensely complicated thing to do because the owners of firms that we call American firms are not themselves just American. Right? So there are, so to speak, Nigerian owners of Exxon. That is, there are rich Nigerians who have stock in Exxon, just as there are rich Americans who do. So there's a global ownership structure and a global class structure. Some people argue that even the idea of using national labels for particular capitalisms no longer really makes sense, that we have a global capitalist class and a global proletariat and then a global contradictory class locations. On the other hand, because citizenship creates huge barriers to labor markets, and because states continue to predominantly regulate class relations within national boundaries, there does seem to be something distinctive about the American class structure compared to the Mexican class structure, the Brazilian class structure, or the French class structure. And so there's this tension between thinking about these questions in national and transnational or global terms. It's a tension that reflects the complexity of the world. It's not a failure of imagination. I don't think there's a solution to that tension by saying, well, if only we could figure it out, there'd be some simple way to understand this. Class structures are So the way I like to think about it is that we can talk about the class structure within any unit of analysis that's of theoretical interest to us. And for different purposes, different units of analysis are of the greatest relevance. For lots of purposes, national boundaries are of great relevance because that's where politics is primarily organized. But there are other purposes, and so one might want to attempt to do a global class structure by looking at the working class that's organized by particular kinds of capital or particular locations of capital.
Yeah, if you were to do that, in that way, could you consider citizenship much like some other form of certification, just like much like doctors have to get licensed or whatever else, you simply just have to get licensed to work in a particular.
Right. And you could. I think it's not a bad idea to think of citizenship as a form of opportunity hoarding, to use the term that has particular standing in the Weberian tradition, a particular form of opportunity hoarding within labor markets. You know, that is, it is a credential to sell your labor in a particular labor market. So just as having a doctor's, an MD is a credential to sell your labor in a particular labor market for medical services, having citizenship is a particular credential to sell your labor market in a particular territorially based market. And illegal immigrants, then, are people who violate that credentialing process. Just as there are lawyers without law degrees who say they have a law degree and nobody bothers to check, and every once in a while there are these scandals that occur. Somebody becomes a prominent lawyer, turns out they never went to law school because in their first job nobody checked, and then in their second job their credential was having worked in their first job. Well, that's essentially, one might argue, just a different form of the same issue that citizenship represents. Yeah.
Yeah, I just had a quick question for you, Daniel. So are you saying then your argument is that as a result of the reduction in industrial production, that classes begin to dissipate, or at least the effects of classes?
No. What I'm saying is that the effect of a strictly polar model of class begins to dissipate. And it can be argued, it has been argued, that that never truly existed in the first place, yeah, and that there are always what we can refer to as contradictory class location, the petty bourgeois, and managers, and things like that. But once we start to deindustrialize, as we have within the United States, this polar model of class becomes even more obsolete, I think.
So then, my question would be, how does that work with this idea of the differentiation of jobs and whatnot? I mean, because in this case, with the reduction of industrial production, I mean, it's not like factories had... So with the reduction in industrial production, we have probably, I think, an increase in the service sector. And so that's your main focus, it seems. And so then would you be arguing that there's more differentiation in jobs in the service sector than there are?
Well, it's not solely the service sector that is grown.
Sure. Okay.
I mean, I think, for example, the production of knowledge has become more valuable for a hotter commodity nowadays than it might have been during the Industrial Revolution. I think just our economies and our focus, labor is taking place. But it's taking place in different forms, and some of where you might have found a factory worker, to be sure, a large portion of those people who are going to do this, would have ended up in the service sector.
Here's a way I think you can think of this differentiation problem, and then ask the question how it bears on class. But first, to clarify,
sure,
the differentiation. There was a time in which, if you were in a particular line of work, and because of technical change or economic conditions, you lost your job, you could go on the labor market and look for a very different kind of job with a good chance of getting. So you lose your job as a semi-skilled machinist in a auto factory, and there's a downturn and the auto industry is laying off people and you're looking for another job, and you get a job as a semi-skilled worker in a refrigerator factory, you know, making home appliances. And it's not exactly the same skills that you had before, but mostly you learn the skills on the job in both cases. And the employer sees that you were had a good employment record, you clearly were a reliable person, and that's the credential that really matters. Is this a good worker or not? That would imply that there's not much difference between working on an assembly line in an auto industry and working on an assembly line in a home appliance industry. There are differences. They're not exactly the same. But they're pretty transferable competences. Right, so that would be low differentiation. And what's interesting is it's low differentiation even though there's a huge differentiation between refrigerators and automobiles. And there's nothing that you use a refrigerator for that you could substitute for an automobile. But now in the service sector, let's see if it's still true. I mean, in some cases, if you are a computer programmer and you were trained in the 1990s and you have the full gambit of programming skills and that you learned in the 90s, and you're working along in a particular sector, and then there's a big downturn and you lose your job, there'd be many computer programming jobs that you're not eligible for. You simply don't have the knowledge that it requires, and the fact that you were a skilled programmer isn't sufficient because, you know, you learn, you're great at COBOL, but nobody who's applying, who's using programmers wants COBOL, and the fact that you knew COBOL doesn't make it easy for you to learn whatever, you know, the new programming languages. It requires a lot of additional energy, you know, to jump the divide. So if a university starts denying tenure to sociologists and other universities are expanding engineering, the fact that you both have PhDs means that you have nothing in common, right? It's an illusion that there's a labor market for PhDs. There's no, this would be Grusky's argument. There is no such thing as a labor market for PhDs. It's a fiction. That's a nominal category. There's a labor market for PhDs in sociology. There's a labor market for PhDs in mechanical engineering. But there's absolute barriers between them. You cannot move from one to the other. Now that means that that's the fragmentation that they're talking about.
Right, yeah. Well, I mean, I was just talking about his argument related to, like, when this started happening. And I was curious as to when, like, I was curious if you think that then in other countries, like, let's say Mexico, where a lot of industrial production is moving, class consciousness is, or, well, class is rising.
I don't know what's going on. Like, I couldn't tell you definitively, but I think... the nature of an economy does bear on the nature of a class system. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, if Mexico moved to a predominantly industrial economy, you might see, you know, something more divided along the lines of workers and proletariats. I mean, there would be, you know, complexities there, but I think that would be fair to say.
Okay. You know, as to the historical timing of this, I think it's probably best not to think of this as there was some moment in which the old model was, quote, correct, and then something happened and it's no longer correct with respect to this issue of complexity. Rather, I think, right from the start, there was processes both of increasing and decreasing complexity, as there is even today. There are processes at work now which are reducing complexity. It's not just increasing complexity. That is, there are processes that are home, by reducing complexity, I mean creating more homogeneity in the conditions of life, the forms of subordination, and the strategic problems that people face. There are some processes at work which are homogenizing and others which are differentiating. And that was true right from the beginning. And it's not exactly which of these weighs most heavily in people's lives. It's not simply a question of the structural conditions. It's also a question of their collective organization. So you could say, of course, there's no labor market in PhDs because they're separate. There's all these fragmented labor markets, but there are faculty unions that bring together PhDs in engineering and sociology. And the reason is that although the labor market is highly fragmented, they're all employed by the same institution, and they're all subjected to the same degradation of labor within the university setting, and they're all subjected to pressures of increasing privatization of and penetration of corporations into the university. If they had a collective organization, then that would mean that the things which unite them, as opposed to the things which fragment them, have a vehicle for collective action. So it's partially in the absence of collective organization that all this fragmentation and differentiation seems to be the predominant reality that people live under. Yeah.
But their argument is like that, right? I mean, they point to some point, some social formation back in the history, probably early 20th century. There was a big industrial class, and it was another polarized society between two classes, capitalists and workers. And as Pakulski says in the 175, I mean, where he summarizes the three phases of classes from classlessness, he says that postmodern post-industrial societies, I mean, that he points to a historical moment where the so-called corporatism of Western European countries and United States broke and lead to the post-industrial societies, like in Daniel Bell's argument, and then classes became irrelevant. But he misses the point that, like you said, there were all these relations of class and the other things, the so-called interpenetrations, he argued, they were all complex. They were more complex in the times of the early capitalism. There were feudal bonds between people, and there were familial, patriarchal, communal relations were more central in defining people's vocations, what they're doing, their jobs. I mean, that's, I think his epistemology of reading the history of capitalism is kind of problematic, seeing that there was one point industrial capitalism, there were all class. We could only talk about class, but I think that makes more problems.
So I think his answer to that would be that early capitalism was also very complex. Capitalist development wiped out that early form of complexity, or at least reduced it. Late capitalism adds new complexity. So there are these two trajectories of reducing complexity from the complicated interpenetrations of pre-capitalist forms, familial forms, guild systems, artisanal relations, all of that stuff which characterized 19th century capitalism. That gradually gets obliterated through the process of de-skilling and industrialization and homogenization that Marx especially emphasized. And in contemporary writers, Harry Braverman makes a big point of it. That trajectory reached its peak in the height of the industrial capitalist era, somewhere in the course of the middle of the 20th century, you know, somewhere in there. It varies somewhat from country to country. But then new forms of complexity, which produce all these new fragmentations, functional differentiations, occupational specializations, emerge. And the pace at which those differentiation occurs is more rapid than the pace at which new forms of homogeneity are created. And therefore you get this post-industrial fragmentation. Now, my view is I don't deny those two trajectories. I think it's interesting and important. And it is indeed a problem that collective actors who attempt to engage in what I call the process of class formation, not just class structure, but forming collective actors on the basis of this class structure, it is a problem which they face. There was a particular period where that problem was simpler. Mind you, even when it was simple, it wasn't that simple. I mean, the United States had a form of collective organization around craft unions that deeply fragmented the working class and blocked all sorts of collective actions because precisely it was organized on the basis of whether you were a carpenter or a plumber or a pipe fitter or a machinist. And these were all hostile, separate corporate bodies. But in the course of the 1930s, with the rise of industrial unionism, and then eventually the merger of these two, some kind of collective class formation emerged out of that process. So I do think the process of class formation is more complicated now, or faces particular obstacles around collective action. But the difficulty in overcoming those obstacles is not just because of the complexity of the class structure. It's because, for example, the legal rules for class formation, for formation of unions, are so hostile to unionization in the United States that it makes it very difficult to engage in step-by-step strategies that would overcome these fragmentations. And that is not, the complexity of the class structure doesn't cash out as a simplified form of class formation, not because of complexity per se, but because of complexity and institutions of social regulation. And that's what the topic of class formation is all about that transition. And the solutions to understanding all of that is why we have to have a theory of the state and ideology, not just a theory of class structure.
So do you think he would say, he does say that class varies historically. Would he, hypothetically speaking, let's say, the economy keeps getting worse and worse and worse, and is a proliferation of these, of unions, of these sort of vehicles that push class-based identities and consciousness and that sort of thing. Is he saying that it can vary historically and this trajectory is going one way, but there's nothing inherent that prevents it from going the other way?
Pakulski would say that this is irreversible. I think he has a very strong view. He believes that the fragmentation and incoherence generating complexity are so structurally powerful that you can't really overcome it. Now, he wouldn't, I think, say that there's no imaginable future in which this could be reversed, but he would say so long as the structural tendencies are the way they are now, you won't get coherent class formations emerging out of this complicated cross-cutting reality. I think it's because he focuses too much on the problem of, as does Grusky, on the problem of the extreme heterogeneity and complexity in labor markets, which really do divide people, so that the interests of engineers, so to speak, and English professors are very different at the level of their own efforts to get jobs in the labor market. And not focusing enough on the structure of the capitalist class and the state, that is the organizations that are doing the employing. So it's as if you can have many different kinds of workers who are all exploited by the same kind of capitalist. And they share interests in common because of the nature of their common enemy, even though they have very different interests in terms of their micro strategies for individually coping with that common enemy, as it were. Workers in the United States and Mexico who are employed by the same capitalist corporation, in one sense, have identical interests with respect to their opposition to a particular powerful organization, the corporation that's employing them. But of course, because of the different conditions and alternatives and fallback options and family structures and all these things, in their micro settings, they have extremely different interests in that respect. And again, it's a lack of a collective vehicle to express their common interests which renders their realities so fragmented, as opposed to it's a natural condition to be fragmented as opposed to united. So you could argue that when he says the death of classes, he's really referring to the death of class formation, right, and class ideology, but might sort of reify, you know, class structure and class interests, you know, because he responds to your point by saying, oh, but global capitalism,
right?
You know, yeah. So he's certainly, he might have embedded in his argument the idea of capitalist class society.
Right. Although he tends to say global markets or global competition rather than global capitalism, I think.
Okay.
You know, the rhetoric, he wants to avoid the word capitalism because that involves a class language for thinking about these.
But we can say to him that as long as one employee tries to stay longer in the bathroom and take longer bathroom breaks, every single individual, whether it's a plumber or whether it's an engineer, we can talk about a very basic form of struggle and class, which can bring the interests of very different occupational categories together.
Right, so the relations of, they share interest in the relations of production, but not in the relations of exchange. It's one way of talking.
Yeah.
But they can only express their interest in the relations of exchange, not the relations of production. And that's why it looks like it's completely fragmented. I mean, that, I'm supposed to be somewhere at 12, but it shows my priorities that I see. Next to class, I will get the lecture on gender up this afternoon. The next two classes are on gender. I think what we'll do is have next Monday's discussion, actually, the two lectures also have breakdown in what we need to do today.
So I noticed as I corrected the